Today's program has been brought to you by Fairway Market, like no other market, a New York City institution that sells the best local, national, and international artisan foods for prices that can't be beat. For more information, visit fairwaymarket.com. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Welcome to Chef's Story. I'm Dorothy Cann Hamilton from the International Culinary Center, and today I'm out in Bushwick, Brooklyn at heritageradionetwork.org, and my chef today is an old friend from the early days of pioneering new American cuisine. It is none other than Alfred Portale from Gotham Restaurant. And today you're going to hear from one of the people I consider one of the chefs who changed the whole concept of American cuisine. Alfred has been feted by our industry as one of the greatest chefs working in America today. Way back in 1998, he got the IACP and Food and Wine Magazine Award for his Gotham Bar and Grill cookbook. But, you know, that was no surprise, because within 3 months of opening Gotham Bar and Grill, he got 3 stars from the New York Times. No small feat. And he earned those three stars 4 more times. It is so hard to sustain a restaurant at that level, and we're going to hear all about it. In 1993, he won Best Chef of New York City from the James Beard Awards. And in 2002, they were chosen as the best restaurant by James Beard, bar none in this country. And in 2006, Alfred won the ultimate award for a chef in our industry. He was chosen the outstanding chef by James Beard Foundation. I can't tell you, Alfred, how excited I am to have you and honored. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you, Dorothy. It's great to see you, and I'm really happy to be here.
Well, you know what? Way back when, I mean, I should mention also that you're going to be the host of the 25th anniversary for the Silver Anniversary for the James Beard Awards this year. But when exactly did you start cooking? What was the first year of your of Gotham? Let's just say, when did Gotham get
I was going to say, you know, I started cooking professionally. I had applied to the Culinary Institute, and they turned me down because I had never worked in a restaurant. So I'm from upstate New York, outside of Buffalo, and I went out and got a job working in the best restaurant I could find in Buffalo, New York at the time, and went to the Culinary Institute, spent a year in France, fast forward to Gotham Bar and Grill. That was in 1985, and the restaurant was celebrating its 1 year anniversary to the day that I started. So a lot has changed since.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's go back to Buffalo.
Okay.
So tell me.
Great.
What are your food memories from Buffalo?
They're all amazing. I mean, you know, I come from a very large extended Italian American family. Both my parents were born here, but my two sets of grandparents came over from Sicily. We had a very rich, sort of large, extended family with lots of entertaining, all the things that you would imagine. My mother, you know, canned her own tomatoes and fruits and made, you know, pasta sauce, and I helped her roll out raviolis for the holidays, and we made Christmas cookies and had big family barbecues where we, you know, hand-cranked ice cream and all those just glorious memories. My grandfather made his own wine, and it was this brown, foul-smelling, oxidized liquid, which...
Did you like it? No, I
never even tasted it. So I had very, very good
roots.
Really pleasant food memories.
Let me ask you something. Did you have a fig tree in your backyard?
You know, we didn't. We did not have...
We're at Roberta's, and we're in Brooklyn, and Alfred kept saying, I bet they have fig trees in the backyard. And then we're at Roberta's, and they have a great courtyard here. Oh, look at the fig trees
I'm
here.
I'm so jealous. You know what? Fig trees were not that prolific in Buffalo, New York. I can't remember.
I would imagine the weather might have something.
Yeah, that I think they call it the lake effect.
Yes.
All the snow.
So was there a large Italian community in Buffalo?
Yes, there is. The population has declined in Buffalo, but there is a large Italian neighborhood. My grandfather, when I was young, lived in that neighborhood, and my family grew up in the suburbs, and so wasn't an old school Italian neighborhood, but it still exists. Great Italian bakeries, really wonderful memories to pick up.
So were your food memories? Did you think of yourself as Italian American or Sicilian American?
Italian American, I
Italian.
Would say.
Yeah. So was the food, you know, full of pistachios and, you know, honey and all that, you know, the...
You know, what I learned at that point in my life was the importance of family and dining together. We were, you know, we had to be home for dinner every single night, no excuses. The family got together, we talked business.
How many siblings?
I have two. I've got an older brother and sister. And every Sunday we had the sort of classic Italian big meal at about 1 o'clock in the afternoon. So it really taught me the importance of having dinner together with family. And I know how hard it gets and. When you have children after school programs and all that, but it was an important lesson to me. Mm-hmm. And the other thing is my mother was an accomplished cook, but she really cooked food every night. There was never any convenience foods always seasonal, and she did a lot of preserving.
Did you always just want to be a chef, or what was your journey?
I didn't know really that I wanted to be a chef, although I enjoyed helping my mother cook mainly. And in, I think as early as high school, I took home economics classes just so I could be the only guy in a classroom full of girls. That was the plan back then. But no, I didn't.
You didn't get ribbed by the other guys, the football players? You know, Charlie Palmer was a football player, and so was I.
He was, I was interested in art at a very early age. We had a next door neighbor who was an artist, and I took painting lessons with her, like. As early as 10 years old.
Really?
Yeah. So I was always interested in drawing, painting, sculpting, design. And I had a very craftsman-like mentality. I was the kind of person who would take apart the vacuum cleaner and put it back together again, you know, stuff like that. So, and I was interested really in art. And early on, I had tried to make a sort of a commercial success out of creating sort of handmade jewelry and belt buckles and things.
Now, how did you get to jewelry from this? Was this college years or?
Yeah, early college.
So where'd you go to college?
The University of Buffalo. I was there for 2 years specifically studying jewelry making and design.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Again, a friend of the family who was a fairly accomplished jeweler, but not commercial jewelry, you know, whole handmade pieces, took me under his wing, and I studied with him, learning casting and setting stones.
So was it the mechanics of the jewelry or the beauty, the form?
All the above. The design, the elements, designing the pieces on paper, were very important to me. And I had a lot of successful designs, but you know, not knowing, you know, being young and not understanding that a craft like that takes years to master, I was very impatient, like most youngsters. So things weren't happening fast enough. I could design the pieces, but I didn't have the experience and sort of the time-honored, you know, apprenticeship to actually execute. So I was, I had this idea where I was going to sort of fast track and create a commercial enterprise. And then I was introduced to the Culinary Institute. And
how did that come about?
Well, I was looking at an old, this is, I've told this story so many times. It was an old French book by Henri Pelleprat. I'm pretty sure it's Mastering the Art of, no, it's Modern Cooking. There's a couple of different titles once it was translated, but Henri Pelleprat was certainly the author. And there are these big color plates of buffets, probably in the 40s and 50s, of these most amazing, you know, chauffoir and aspic and tallow sculptures and ice sculptures and just and canapes and petit fours, just beautifully decorated and arranged. And I looked at that and I thought that, you know, wow, that is so, that's edible art. It's amazing. I would love to do that. And then right at that moment, I was introduced to the Culinary Institute, which at the time I believed was a chef college. And I thought, wow, I could go to college, to this school for 2 years, graduate, and be a chef, and be producing these things in this old French book. And it was under that misguided thinking that I enrolled in the culinary and started cooking.
But you know, you did study those techniques, I'm sure.
Yeah, but I learned quickly that unless you're, you know, a member of the, you're competing in the Bocuse d'Or, or you're, you know, in the culinary Olympic team, no one does that kind of stuff anymore.
Well, I can't wait to get into your food that you do at Gotham, because it is among the most beautiful on a plate. But
thank
it's
you.
Incredibly delicious. But we'll get into the architecture later. So you went to culinary and you graduated. You graduated first in your class of 80, I am told.
Yes.
Doesn't surprise me. So what kind of opportunities and doors opened to you after that?
At the time was in love with French cuisine, and
why was that?
Well, it was such a strong influence then. I mean, the to my mind, in the early 80s, the greatest chefs in the world were certainly all the Michelin starred chefs like Chappelle and Sondrens and Gerard and Toigrot and, you know, these guys. And I only knew of them through a French cookbook series by Robert Lafont, which was not translated, and I used to buy it at the Alliance Francaise bookstore. That's where I found the books. So I would that was my introduction to French cuisine, at the Culinary Institute they have a standing library. So I was trying to, I just wanted to figure out how I could get to France. And weeks before I was graduating, I learned that Michel Gerard, who had a very successful food shop in Paris called Comptoir Gourmand, a whole line of all of his products and charcuterie, and he was popular for Cuisine Mansur at the time.
Which was diet cuisine.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. And he was going to launch a Cuisine Mansur in New York, and they were looking for a couple of cooks to work there. It wasn't a restaurant. Wasn't sure really what it was, but I interviewed for the job while I was at the Culinary Institute, and there were about 30 of us in the room. And I remember that the man was, it was Alan Rayburn, who was director of restaurants for all of the stores. And afterwards he said, well, send me your to the group, you know. He made a presentation. He said, if anyone's interested, send a resume and, you know, we'll be in touch or some such thing. I found out that, I sort of bribed an instructor and found out that Mr. Rayburn was having lunch afterwards at the Escoffier room, and I barged in on his lunch
really?
And said, I'm interested in this position. I can be in New York tomorrow. And he was so impressed with that that he granted me the interview. I flew to, or took the train to New York from Poughkeepsie, and they hired me on the spot, essentially. So working for Gerard in New York, I was invited to then work in France, where I spent a year cooking.
Whoa. So actually, we need to take a little break right now. But when we come back, we're going to talk about a little bit about France and then a lot about Gotham.
Okay.
Hi, I'm Steve Jenkins from Fairway Markets. I've devoted my idiot career to the old ways, the old recipes, the old tools, the old geography of where serious foods come from for centuries. And I've strived to make these wonderful things available to New Yorkers for 37 years, so it's a fait accompli for us to support Heritage Radio Network. And I hope you will too, and I hope you'll keep tuning in. For more information, please visit fairwaymarket.com.
Well, welcome back. You're listening to Chef's Story, and I'm Dorothy Cann Hamilton. And today, my guest chef is none other than the great Gotham chef, Alfred Portale. So, Alfred, we just heard that you got on a plane to France after graduating culinary and getting a job with Michel Girard in the early 80s at his New York outpost. So what was it like for a young American to work in Paris? No, it wasn't Paris, I think.
No, it...
In France in those days.
Well, you know, I tell the story, but you know, in back in the 80s, you know, if you were a young chef looking for inspiration and excellent training, you really, you know, going to France was sort of the way to find that. And nowadays, of course, there are so many excellent chefs in this country that it's not as critical. And of course, you could always go to Spain or Italy, or Japan for that matter. But there are great chefs in every city in America. But that wasn't really the case when I graduated from culinary school. So what I signed up for basically was I was there for 11 months working. So what I signed up for was working doubles.
That means from 6 in the morning to 11 at night.
Right. Like 14-hour days, 6 days a week for no pay. That was basically what I signed up for. I did get room and board at one of the restaurants. I worked at with the Trois Gros brothers in Rouen for half the time. Huh. I was fortunate enough to work with Jean and Pierre. And then with Gerard for the second half of the year. And then I got to live in Paris for about a month and a half. And, you know, each day was just charting, you know, which market, which bookstore, which, you know, culinary, you know, what restaurant, which bakery.
Would you be a different chef today if you didn't have that part?
Absolutely.
How do you think it formed you?
Well, in terms of, you know, it formed me in many, many ways because, you know, first of all, you learn a tremendous appreciation for the quality of food and the importance of quality and also local and seasonal food. I learned all about charcuterie and cheeses. You know, you develop a palate and a taste for these things and for wines. And also, you know, the excellence that you find even in across the board in restaurants and service. In even the smallest little town in France, there, you know, you could find an excellent croissant or a great baker. So, it really sort of sets a standard, and you learn an appreciation for that kind of quality.
So, fast forwarding to Gotham, what are the aspects of Gotham that you're most proud of that come from your formation? What are the values that you hold?
Well, when I started at Gotham, Gotham had been open for about a year. It was well received. My partners did an excellent job designing the restaurant. It was designed by a young architect, James Bieber, but the concept of the design and the space was very, very good. My partners had a vision about how this space would function, and it would be fun, but the food piece of it was lacking. When I came there, I was interested in like super intricate, high-end, labor-intensive cooking, like most young chefs are. But coming from a restaurant in France where sometimes four cooks would be working on one dish, or 30 cooks did 60 covers a day.
That's why your pay was so high over there.
So I had a bit of a quandary because Gotham, you know, has 160 seats and now does, you know, 350 covers. So how to apply what I learned and all the precision and the intricacy and you know, preparation, that high touch food, how could I be satisfied and be able to create it on a scale the size of Gotham? That was the first thing. But one other really important lesson I learned was, you know, at the time in New York when Gotham opened, the very fine restaurants, the 3- and 4-star restaurants, were very formal. There was a lot of pretension at the door. You know, there were tuxedoed captains, and if you didn't know a lot about wine or couldn't produce or pronounce Shoshana Montmartre properly, you were sneered at. There wasn't a rest. That was sort of the norm. And what I thought back then was, why not create a dining experience that has excellent food, excellent informed service, a democratic door policy, that is fun, and offers value, and doesn't have all that.
So you were breaking the mold. A lot of people say Union Square, and we're going to bring up, was
exactly
farm centric. It was off of the farmers market, and it was breaking the mold on having a stuffy restaurant. But quite frankly, you were doing that before they opened.
That's correct. And Danny is a great friend.
He lived upstairs, didn't he?
He lived upstairs.
I wonder where he got the concept.
No, he certainly, you know, wore that on
no
his
offense,
sleeve.
No offense, Danny.
And sort of championed that whole pro-guest. But the truth is, I learned it in France. It was one of the lessons I learned. And it was really because when I was at Trois Gros, that was a family-run restaurant. It was a 3-star excellent restaurant, but the idea of family and the way we were treated as employees was very different. Gerard was aristocratic and pretentious. And I mean,
so how were you in the kitchen with your staff? I mean, did you carry it back to be aristocratic,
you know,
or family-oriented?
My mother always used to say, you know, be consistent, be firm, but be loving, you know. And you have to be very demanding. And
wait a minute, New York Magazine a number of years ago did a whole story on you and all the great chefs that came out of your kitchen.
That's right.
So I don't know what you were doing with them back there, but you were very successful and they still love you. So maybe we'll just move on.
Okay, excellent.
from there. So how did your food evolve at Gotham over the years? I mean, you came there with maybe all of this French influence, but then where, you know, it's 29 years. Wow.
Yeah.
28, 29? I mean,
it's 28 years now.
Okay, so what are the benchmarks along the way?
Well, it's constantly evolving and changing. It's always been, fortunately, I love and continue to love what I do. And Gotham's success also relies on a group of a team that also is very talented and cares deeply about the restaurant. And it is a very fluid, very active management and creative process that takes place on a daily basis. We, after 26 or 7 years, we continually, on a weekly, daily basis, just analyze the operation, work on menu, work on where we are and how to improve and how to stay current. Gotham's early success was basically because we figured out, I think, ahead of a lot of people, what customers want. And I think we continue to ask ourselves all the time, you know, that question. And that's what keeps us so current and fresh and dynamic.
Well, we're going to have a guest with us in the third part of this program. And I think we'll get more into the whole gestalt of what Gotham is doing. So if I asked you, how has your food changed since 1985 to 2012? Take one plate for me and tell me how you did it in 1985 and how you would do it today.
Well, I'm not sure I could take one plate, but I mean, we were talking about this the other day. When we set up the line for service, we would finish the sauces like you did back then with butter, and you'd finish everything with butter. We used to use 24 or 25 pounds of butter to set up the station on a busy Saturday night. Now we probably use 2. So the other thing was, early on I had this style that came from my jewelry design days, but also we didn't talk about this, but I was very interested in Japanese bonsai. And as a 16-year-old, I was a member of the Western New York Bonsai Society.
No.
I kid you not. And you know, as much as a 16, 17, 18-year-old could possibly understand about something so complex.
Wait a minute, and you were a football player, too.
Yeah.
Doing home economics. This is something. This is to write home about.
By the age of 20, I had a small collection of Japanese bonsai trees, miniature trees. Anyway, but that sensibility of design, and if you know anything about it, sort of drove me in my way of designing the plate. So that's what was described as architectural cuisine. And we became very well known for stacking food in our architectural presentations. We don't do that at all anymore.
You know, other people were plating and it was sort of one level, but you had about 3 or 4. Height was a very important part in the early days.
Yeah, and you know, as soon as that became sort of a trend or a fad, that's when we stopped doing it. Mm-hmm. Now more than ever, it's really about the quality of the ingredients, which has fortunately gotten better and better and better and better, and continues to, you know, between when I started cooking for Michel Gérard Comptoir Gourmand to now, it's so much easier because the quality is there and the appreciation for quality is there. People truly, myself included, really care about where their food came from and how, and to the extent that it's, you know, how it was raised or how, if it's clean and all those things. And, you know, that is integrated in everything we do at Gotham.
So is your food better today because the products you can access are better today? This is a thoughtful man. He's not going to give me an easy yes or no.
You know, I think it's better today because the ingredients are better. I think the technique my technique and technique in general has evolved greatly, and is more sophisticated and better. There are a lot of things contributing to it.
Well, how do you get inspiration today? Where do you look for it?
Hasn't changed a lot. I get inspiration just about from everywhere and from anyone who is excellent at what they do. I think about food if I'm, you know, walking through an art exhibit. I walk the market 3 times a week on my way to Gotham on Monday, Wednesday, and Fridays, and think about food then. Basically, also books and travel are a big source of inspiration. Other chefs and other restaurants.
Okay, well,
Roberta's, for instance.
Oh, we're having a great time out here, and we're going to eat lunch after it. That's the only way to get these chefs to come out here. So anyway, we're going to take a break here, Alfred, and we'll be right back.
Thank you.
Like what you hear so far? Support the network and become a member. Membership helps us bring you the best food radio in the world and gives you access to thousands of dollars in discounts at the sustainably minded businesses that support us. To become a member, visit heritageradionetwork.org today.
Well, welcome back. You're listening to Chef Story, and today I have the pleasure of interviewing the iconic and inspirational chef, Alfred Portale of Gotham. And today we also have a great guest with us, his general manager at Gotham, Brett Sensis. So, Brett, welcome.
Well, thank you, Dorothy. Thanks for having us here. It's great to be out here in Brooklyn.
Well, you know, I'm so happy you're both here because now I know I can get a reservation. So if you're not around, you know, Brett, you're on my speed dial.
Anytime.
Okay. Well, let me ask. You've been with Gotham for the last 5 years, right?
A little over 5 years.
Over 5 years. So tell me about the relationship between the chef and the general manager, and how do you two work together?
You know, to oversimplify, it's Brett and I basically make not all the decisions, but most of the we're the sort of the creative directors and of the restaurant, work very, very closely on all aspects.
So, do you have similar values and ideas about where? I mean, do you have to have a symmetry really in where you're going?
Yeah, I think, you know, Alfred hired me and brought me on, and then I had to really come to understand Gotham. I mean, whenever you start working for something that's 25 years old, I think when I started, or 24, it takes a while for me to really understand the gestalt of it and understand how Alfred worked. One of the, you know, great things about Alfred is that he's very giving to his employees. Like, he really allows for a lot of input. Now, when it comes to the final decision, it's his voice, but he really gives the employees in the kitchen, but also in the front of the house, a lot of say in how things are done.
So you have 150 seats at Gotham, right?
I think it's about 165.
165. So how many covers do you do on a hot night?
Well, you know, during the season, it's in the fourth quarter of every year. That's our busiest season. You know, we'll do 300 covers, and on Saturday nights, and at the heat of it, you know, we'll do 350.
350. And so how many employees do you have?
We have 118, I believe, at the moment.
This is an army. I mean, you know, this is, and it has to work. I get the feeling, Alfred, that you're very detail-oriented. And so what is it like with the precision that has to go between, you know, the front of house, back of house? I don't get to really talk to chefs a lot about that relationship, but since you're both here, I'd love to ask, how does that work?
Well,
if you could just see how Alfred's looking at Brett right now.
I'm wondering which answer he's going to give.
Definitely, my focus is more front of the house. You know, Alfred will often ask what I think of a dish, but I don't really have much to do with the dish creation. You know, I was telling Dorothy before we started that, you know, sometimes one of the challenges that I face is that, you know, I'm always constantly trying to get things done. I'm sort of the motor at times. And Alfred is really trying to make things perfect. So even front of the house and back of the house, you know, how things are done is very, very important to Alfred and very precise. Whereas I just, like, sometimes I'm always just saying, let's just get it done. You know? So that tension, I think, is really productive in many ways. And I think it works to keep us
For the both of you, who's your ideal customer? I know you love them all.
I think the thing that's interesting to think about in restaurants today is that the customers also help us raise our game, because they're so educated today that the questions and the experience that is a very symbiotic one now between the kitchen, the front of the house staff, and the customer. So the ideal customer is someone who comes in and really cares about what we do on a daily basis, because that gives us a lot of joy to entertain somebody like that.
So you finally stepped in. Well, let me ask the other thing. There are so many chefs now that are opening mini bistros, you know, their restaurant light, different cities and things like that. After 28 years, you have one outpost. Why haven't you gone the big route of rolling them out?
Well, 3 years ago, we opened or had a plan to expand, and we opened in the iconic Fontainebleau Hotel in Miami Beach. And the reason, and there was meant to be a Fontainebleau casino in Las Vegas, which also was built but never opened. This was in 2009. I think what was key there was that we found a group in Fontainebleau that really understood the food and beverage remarkably well. These weren't just like casino guys or hotel guys. They really, really appreciated what we did, and we were confident enough in their ability to partner with. So, you know, that's been an excellent relationship, and I think you'll see perhaps something else from the Gotham team in New York.
Well, you know, when I think of you, Alfred, and your food, I don't think steakhouse. And, you know, because the food is so seasonal tell me why.
You're correct. But let me describe. They wanted a Gotham Barn Grill, but they also wanted a steakhouse. And they asked me if the two could basically coexist. And I said, why don't you let me do a Gotham steak, which would have all the beautiful composed appetizers and entrees and the great pastas and desserts that we're so well known for. And I will add a steakhouse component to the menu and with the side dishes and a huge raw bar and so on. And that's really what it is. It's a hybrid. And what I love more than anything is I can grill over hardwood down in Miami. I have a 5-foot grill, wood-burning grill that we're grilling all the food on. And that is, for a chef in New York, that's a dream. or from New York.
So do you have to, are you only in charge of the food down there, or Brett, do you get involved with the management? And
no, you know, when we set it up, I helped Alfred design the whole structure of the management and the service, and we did all the training manuals, and we're very involved in the opening. But really now it's Alfred's food that in the hotel really manages that yeah. property from
and there is, you know, some crossover with promotions and special events, and mm-hmm. you know, we host an event during the Miami Wine and Food Festival, and you know, there are some terms of daily operations, the hotel
management. There's a dialogue between us, but it's really its own thing.
Well, knowing the reputation of your restaurant and your personal reputations, you must have lots of middle managers that work for you that are incredibly talented and very hardworking. What do you do to keep them inspired and excited? And I would think this is one of the hardest things for a chef and a restaurateur.
Well, I think it's definitely difficult to keep people, particularly in this day and age when you have so much excitement in the food world. I mean, one of the things, I'm walking around the compound today here at Roberta's, and I'm just amazed at how many young people they have here who are clearly excited about rolling dough and spreading cinnamon and growing a fig tree, you know, and I just can't help but be excited by that. Now, on a daily basis, you know, we have a fairly robust management team, and you know, there is change, and oftentimes it's difficult going through those changes. But really, ultimately, we try to hire people who bring something to the table, and we give them freedom and a voice, and I think that helps us keep people for a while.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I recognized a long time ago, you mentioned all the mentoring and all the great people who have come through Gotham, not only from the kitchen, but front of the house as well.
I know Scott Carney is our new Dean of Wine at the school.
Is he really?
He really is.
Oh, my goodness.
He and Larry Gotham. Stone are both, we do a sommelier course.
And oh, that's excellent.
He's fabulous. Anyway, sorry. Yeah. He's one of the people that came through your...
Scott was a general manager and ran our wine department very early on. He was our first GM and was there for 10 years and earned his Master Sommelier accreditation while at Gotham. Mm-hmm. Anyway, what I recognized a long time ago was that our employees are truly our most valuable asset in the restaurant, bar none. Mm-hmm. So if you think that way, you know, you just have to, you've got to keep them, because you can't always reward them with money. I mean, as we, you know, you just have to keep them nurtured and inspired, and you need to appreciate a job well done. And you need to, you know, correct correct them when they're not, you know, doing their job as well. But keep them motivated and happy, and keep them learning. And that's how you essentially.
What percentage of your time does that take?
Well, it's all the time.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's every day.
Even when it's not, you're not doing it, you're thinking about it. It's you know, it's incredibly important to the operation. I mean, it is a people business. Mm-hmm. It's about being there, being there for the customer, being there for the employees as well.
So being a chef, I mean, a lot of people think, oh, well, you're in there cooking and you're syncing up these great menus. And basically, chef means the chief. You're in charge. You're the CEO. That's what chef means. So, you know, the balance of that. Was that difficult to arrive at? You've done it so well. As I said, you've mentored so many people.
Well, yeah, it's, you know, you just evolve. I mean, I was, when we started 27 years ago, rather, you know, my focus was it was certainly the cuisine and the production of the food and that whole aspect, but it also had I directed a lot of my energy on the philosophy of service and the front of the house. You know, but now, you know, roles have changed. And like I said earlier, we've really built an excellent team. And we succeed because all of us care about Gotham very much, and our customer, and we all, and making it a great experience.
Well, we're going to have to close soon, but I want to point out that you have three cookbooks. You have, in 97, you had Alfred Portale's Gotham Bar and Grill cookbook, and in 2000, your 12 Seasons cookbook. But in 2004, you had a cookbook called Simple Pleasures.
Yes.
Can you tell me a simple pleasure?
Right. Well, right now, all I can think about is that pizza that we're going to be having shortly, and maybe a glass of Italian wine. Mm. That was, you know, it was a great pleasure to do those books, and it was really cookbooks that got me interested in cooking, as I've said, and they're such an important tool for young chefs. And we've been talking recently about doing another book, possibly a little smaller. But that's what I find pleasurable. And what we didn't talk about, and I know we're neighbors up in the country, but I went from making jewelry to I'm now making furniture.
So, are you really?
Yeah, I want to show you some things that after the show that I'm working on.
My gosh. Well, let me, you know, we'll go over. I don't think Jack, our producer, is going to. I was thinking when you were talking about jewelry and design and being a craftsman.
Yeah.
How similar is that to being a chef? Because the craftsmanship part is so important to be able to execute really complicated dishes. Do you see, was there a huge overlay of the kinds of disciplines you needed to be a jeweler, to being a chef or a furniture maker?
Well, I think it was critical to, and continues to be critical to the success of Gotham. Gotham, if you ask people one of the things that they love about the restaurant is the consistency of the experience. And what I said earlier, trying to create dishes, you know, that I did in France when we had 30 cooks doing 60 covers, to being able to produce beautiful, delicious, consistently plated food. That's where my sort of the craftsmanship comes in, and the mechanics of the dish and how the food is purchased, specced, stored, cut, prepped, cooked, finished, and then the design of the plate all go into every single dish, and that's how we can do these amazing dishes for 350 people.
Unbelievable. Unbelievable.
I think the craftsmanship comes out in the kitchen in particular, when there's an inspiration for a new dish in a new season, the original dish goes through an entire process of analyzation and okay, flavors. The flavor's great, but how are we going to execute it? And then it changes multiple times before it really goes on the menu. I mean, it goes through an entire look process, taste process, and then okay, how are we going to execute it? Mm. I've been to Alfred's workshop up in Connecticut, and you know, went from doing some boards, and then suddenly he was creating by hand a dovetailed drawer just because he wanted the challenge of that, which is no easy thing.
On that note, I just want to share something Jacques Pepin, who I think is one of the Zen masters of technique, said to me about craftsmanship and technique. He says, you know, and he paints, he's a beautiful painter. He says, you know how I know I'm a professional chef and not a professional painter? He says, because when I see a beautiful landscape and I try to paint it, it's not quite right. And it's because I don't have the technique.
Yeah.
He says, I know I'm a professional chef because I can think of any dish I want and I can execute it with technique. And in fact, my hand is so trained that I don't even have to tell, my brain doesn't even have to tell my hand what to do. I just think it and it works on its own. Yeah. And when you're doing an incredibly complex dish, you don't have time to say, do this hand, do this, that hand. That's when you know you really have a master chef.
Yeah.
And I know sitting here today, I'm in the presence of a master chef.
Thank you.
Thank
Dorothy.
You, Alfred.
Thank you.
And we'll see you next time on Chef Story.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.